Whitehall, Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. This is Northern Light for Tuesday, March 19th. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
Our series on North Country's prisons continues with an interview with a journalist who embedded and became a corrections officer.
You got close like that, and it's not just a topic I'm going to research this month and then I'm going to move on. It's part of my life now.
Lawmakers are in the home stretch of negotiations for the state's 2024 spending plan. The big sticking points are raising income taxes on wealthier residents and cuts in school aid.
Almost half of the school districts in the state will be receiving less funding than they would have anticipated. We're very, very concerned about that.
And the longtime public radio show Vinyl Cafe gets new life in a new podcast. We hear from the producer coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Fisher, Bissett, Muldowney, and McArdle, attorneys and counselors at law with offices in Malone, Tupper Lake, and Saranac Lake. 800-941-5001. And by Adirondack Foundation, connecting generous donors with the causes they care about in the places they love today, tomorrow, and always. More at AdirondackFoundation.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. State and federal prison officials say there's a shortage of staff at correctional facilities. We reported yesterday on why that may be and what impact it's having here in the North Country. We wanted to understand more about what it's like to work inside a prison. Ted Conover is a journalist who had that same question 25 years ago, so he became a corrections officer.
He went through the six-week training in Albany and then worked for 10 months at Sing Sing, the maximum security prison just north of New York City. Conover wrote a book about his experience called New Jack. It's a term used to describe new officers. And he spoke with our Adirondack reporter, Emily Russell, about his experience.
When you first arrive, when you're a new jack, as they say, or a rookie, you just get tested all the time. And people challenge you. They intimidate you. They try to scare you. They succeed. This happened on my first day. I was with a training officer, and a prisoner pretended he acted like he was going to punch me, and his fist stopped right under my chin. And he and the guys he was with laughed, and the training officer kind of laughed too, like, well, on we go. And, you know, in the training academy, they would have said, oh, that's a threat. You write them up, you give them a ticket, and they go before a disciplinary committee. And if they're found guilty, they'll be confined to their cell or a disciplinary building. But in reality, that wasn't the case. You know, you don't write the ticket because this kind of thing happens a lot. And tickets are reserved for when somebody actually gets hurt, not for just when they get scared. So it's a stressful job because that whole power thing and being outnumbered. And I guess also just because it's a negative kind of environment, right? It's a place of punishment where an officer's job is mainly to say no all day. And I think it's that need to assert yourself carefully that is really stressful.
Were you ever injured?
Yeah. I lost my temper one day. There's a vivid description of this in New Jack. And I yelled at a guy who'd been masturbating in front of a female trainee who I was trying to train. And I got so mad at him. And I raised my voice. And that got everybody's attention. And they started mocking me. And I grabbed a mirror that a guy had left on his bars, the bars of the front of his cell. He wasn't allowed to leave it there. There's all these rules. They can hold the mirror out, but they can't leave it on the bars. Unfortunately, I grabbed it while walking in a way that meant I'd have to walk back by his cell to get back to my headquarters. And when I did, he reached out and slugged me on the back of the sort of the side of the head. And it didn't hurt that much. Oh, he spit on me too. And you have to report this kind of thing when it happens, which is humiliating because it sort of shows you've lost control, even if they do it to you. And the sergeant I reported it to asked me what happened, asked me why I was walking close enough to the front of his cell for him to hit me. And I said I didn't want to look scared. And then said in this voice I'll never forget, "And why didn't you grab his arm and break it?" And I thought, whoa, that's actually what had passed through my mind, but it's nothing I would ever have said out loud or even admitted that I'd thought, right? Because that's not who I am. But this guy had been a hostage during a prison uprising right after he got to Sing Sing. He'd been there a long time. And that's this kind of darkness that, yeah, you see can grow in people who spend so many hours a day in that kind of environment. And I'm not excusing it. And I think, you know, the best officers resist those thoughts and stay good people. And yeah, those are the ones I would want to be with. But there's the other side too.
How did that impact your time outside of the prison? You know, when you'd go home to your family, how did the work inside the prison impact your home life?
So not in a good way. At the academy, they told us, you know, don't take it home. Leave it at the gate. Don't treat your family like inmates. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, right, as if that would ever happen. But in fact, when you're in a social situation all day where you're just trying to get people to follow the rules and do what you tell them to, it can be really hard to shift out of it. And it's also really hard to leave the stress behind all of a sudden.
I know you kind of went in to understand, you know, the experience of correction officers. What did your time inside the prison teach you about the experience of people incarcerated?
Well, lots of different kinds of things. One is that you find there are certain people who you really like. And you think, you know, if we had met each other under other circumstances, we'd probably be friends because there's a lot of humanity in a prison. At the same time, it's set up so that you don't know about what they did to get there. And what they drill into you in the academy again and again is most people who end up in a maximum security prison have done something really harmful to somebody else in most cases, right? So you have to temper your natural desire to want to make friends with a sort of skepticism about, well, what kind of person is this? So it's a frustrating place to be a human. And you feel badly for them in all kinds of ways, you know, especially on holidays. As a rookie, I got sent around all over the prison and worked a few days in the visit room where all of a sudden you see these men surrounded by children or their spouses or partners. And you just think, oh my gosh. And a person who can be just really awful to you in the morning, you can see them in the afternoon, and they're suddenly so happy and smiling to have their kids near them and a visit from the outside world.
Did the experience leave a lasting impact on you?
Oh, for sure. It's intense, and you never forget something like this. I was giving a talk at a college afterward, and the college psychologist came up to me and said he thought I had PTSD from the experience. And I kind of laughed, as that seemed to me something a veteran gets, somebody who's seen actual war. But he said, no, you can get it from all kinds of trauma. And, you know, the stories you tell are pretty traumatic. And like you say, you're still having dreams now of prison, even though it's been months since you left. And in some of these dreams, I'm a prisoner. I've been unfairly locked up. Nobody's listening to me about that. I don't really have the dreams much anymore, but it's totally changed the way I think about corrections and the people in it, and also about prisoners. Yeah, you get close like that, and it's not just a topic I'm gonna research this month and then I'm gonna move on. It's part of my life now.
Journalist Ted Conover speaking with Emily Russell. You can hear a longer version of their interview at our website, ncpr.org. And tomorrow on Northern Light, we hear from a mother whose son has been incarcerated in the Adirondacks for years. Visiting a loved one in prison can be complicated, expensive, and sometimes visits are canceled at the last minute. Hear what it's like from one mother's perspective tomorrow on NCPR.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's coming up on 12 minutes past 8. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. For years, humorist Stuart McLean hosted the Canadian public radio show The Vinyl Cafe. Now that warmth and nostalgia about Canadiana is returning, we'll hear from the show's longtime show producer about backstage at The Vinyl Cafe here in a few minutes on Northern Light.
Northern Light is supported by citizen advocates, enabling people with developmental disabilities to live meaningful, self-chosen, and safe lives since 1975. Online at citizenadvocates.net. And by Long Run Wealth, an SEC-registered investment advisor in Lake Placid, providing comprehensive wealth management, retirement, and financial planning solutions. LongRunWealth.com.
An unknown number of St. Lawrence Psychiatric Center employees who used to work at a now-closed boarding school in Ogdensburg have been placed on leave. As Catherine Wheeler reports, the state says it's taking the abuse allegations made in a new documentary seriously.
A new top documentary series on Netflix called The Program alleges that students at the now-closed academy at Ivy Ridge in Ogdensburg underwent physical, sexual, and mental abuse there. The facility was open from 2001 to 2009. According to the Watertown Daily Times, a spokesperson for Governor Kathy Hochul did not specify how many former Ivy Ridge employees now work at the St. Lawrence Psychiatric Center in Ogdensburg. The employees have been placed on leave as they assess the matter. The spokesperson says the state's Office of Mental Health, quote, takes allegations of abuse or neglect seriously and takes measures to ensure state workers who have direct patient care are thoroughly vetted. The state oversees the psychiatric center and workers go through background checks before they're hired. The state did not oversee Ivy Ridge because it was a private boarding institution. Since the documentary premiered, local law enforcement have been inundated with calls and emails about Ivy Ridge. The St. Lawrence County District Attorney's Office and the State Attorney General's Office are both investigating. St. Lawrence County District Attorney Gary Pasqua says he encourages former Ivy Ridge students who want to report abuse to contact his office or the Sheriff's Department. Catherine Wheeler, North Country Public Radio.
State lawmakers are beginning what they hope is the final stretch to agreeing on a state spending plan. The budget is due at the end of the month. As Karen DeWitt reports, the legislature and Governor Hochul have a lot of decisions to make, including whether to raise taxes and how much money to give schools.
Thank you all for joining us today.
Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie convened the first meeting of the General Conference Committee for the State Budget, also known as the Mothership. The public meeting is an annual ritual held at the start of budget negotiations. conditions. After this, the talks will be conducted behind closed doors until an agreement is announced. In between, the Democratic lawmakers, who are mostly in agreement with each other on their spending priorities, have to hash out their differences with Governor Kathy Hochul. She's also a Democrat. One of the biggest differences is over how to distribute school aid. Hochul wants to end a provision known as Halt Harmless. That guarantees that no school district receives less money than it did the previous year. Her plan would result, though, in half of the schools in the state getting fewer resources than they did last year. Senate Leader Stuart Cousins expressed opposition to that earlier this month.
Almost half of the school districts in the state will be receiving less funding than they would have anticipated. We're very, very concerned about that.
Both the Senate and Assembly want to raise income taxes on multimillionaires and corporations to help pay for more school aid and other items. Hochul has said repeatedly that she won't support new taxes.
Raising income taxes is a non-starter for me.
Senate Leader Stuart Cousins and Speaker Hastie say for now, though, everything is on the negotiation table and nothing is off. Speaking to the media after the General Conference Committee meeting, they say it's possible to get the budget wrapped up, potentially with a deal on building new affordable housing, before the Easter holiday on March 31st.
10 days in Albany time is a lifetime. Is a lifetime. Yeah. So there's loads of opportunities. You just have to have willing participants and people, and I think we will get there on the housing deal. I'm hoping we get there on the housing deal. It's critical that we do.
I really do.
The budget is due April 1st, but in past years, it's been anywhere from a few days to a month late. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
The newest candidate for New York's 21st congressional district says he'll run as an independent. The Adirondack Daily Enterprise reports Scott Philip Lewis initially planned to run as a Democrat in his bid to unseat Republican Elise Stefanik, but he's not eligible because he's not registered with that party. Independent candidates have to gather almost three times as many signatures as major party candidates do. Lewis will need 3,500 signatures to get on the ballot. Democrats and Republicans need 1,250 signatures.
And New York Attorney General Tish James says her office has reached a settlement with Walgreens over the retailer's actions during a nationwide baby formula shortage in 2022. Speaking in Buffalo Friday, the Democrat said the pharmacy chain illegally raised the price of formula.
My office found that Walgreens sold more than 2,400 cans and bottles of formula at wrongly inflated prices.
James says the settlement will bring $200,000 worth, that's almost 10,000 cans of baby formula, to New York families in need. The cans will be distributed through nonprofit agencies. Walgreens will also pay a $50,000 penalty to resolve the AG's investigation.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, the short stories and essays of Canada's show The Vinyl Cafe gets new life in a new podcast. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note coming up at 8:42. First, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Last day of winter. Spring equinox occurs at 11:06 tonight. Well, it's going to feel more like winter pretty much for the rest of the week with colder temperatures. We've got snow at times, snow and sleet. Today's highs in the mid to upper 30s. West winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Overnight lows around 30. Still some scattered snow showers tonight, maybe an inch or so of accumulation by tomorrow morning. Light snow, 50-50 chance of light snow tomorrow. A high near 40, and then colder, highs near 30, both Thursday and Friday, with occasional light snow showers. Right now in Canton, mix of sun and clouds and 23 degrees.
The Vinyl Cafe and its host, Stuart McLean, were public radio staples for over two decades. The show brought essays, music, and the stories of Dave and Morley to radios and stages all over Canada.
Though it's been off the air for a decade now, it's found new life with a podcast called Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe. Its host, Jess Milton, a former producer of the show, reflects on that time, which often meant working on the road 200 days out of the year, and pairs her essays with classic stories from McLean and the Vinyl Cafe archives. She joined Northward's host, Mitch Tyke, for a conversation about finding her own voice while honoring the career of her predecessor.
Putting the show together each week sounds like a very specialized, bizarre version of The Amazing Race. Stuart looking for just the right story to tell.
I'm sorry. That is one of the best descriptions I've ever heard, and I am going to steal that. It is perfect.
But for people who haven't heard the podcast and who don't know like what it took to bring that show together week in and week out, in a nutshell, can you describe what chaos it was to put that show together each week?
Well, I don't even know why that was. Like, maybe I was just really bad at my job, but I think we were doing a lot. So Stuart, the first thing you need to know is Stuart and I were the only two people who worked full time on the show. So we had this really tight bond, and we really do or did. I still use the present. We saw the world in the same way and really trusted each other. So that was fantastic. But it was a bit of the two of us were kind of, joined at the hip in a way. And so I think the reason it was chaotic is that, we were doing a lot. So I was away from home. Stuart lived in Toronto and I live near you guys. I live just outside of Ottawa on the Quebec side in a little town called Chelsea, Quebec. So I was away about 150 days a year, sometimes 200 days a year. And Stuart and I would be on tour about 100 days of the year. We lived on a tour bus. There would be about 12 or 13 of us out on the road for 3, 4, 5, even 6 weeks. And we had bunk beds on the bus and we would travel from location to location. And we would record some of those shows for the radio. It kind of felt like a family vacation, which of course, as everyone listening will know, is both the best of times and the craziest of times. So yeah, it was bizarre. And then also Stuart was a character. He lost his glasses about 150 times in a day. And he was he saw the world in such an amazing and unique way. The world isn't always set up for people who see it through a prism that looks a little bit different. And so I loved that about Stuart. You know, like I have pictures of him sitting on benches that say, do not sit here. Not because he was being petulant, but because he just didn't even notice that sign. And they didn't, you know, like, so yeah, it just led to a lot of kind of funny situations, which of course we mined and fictionalized for the show all the time as well.
It sounds like, you know, you would roll into town and then the process of deciding what the story would be would start. And it's incredible to think that such brilliance could be, you know, done at the drop of a hat, that you know, like the muse was on retainer.
Wow. I love the way you think about these things. It's funny, like I didn't realize in the moment how unique that was. But now with the distance from the show and just with age and experience, I realize how unique our style of producing was. So to give people listening a sense, what would happen is, So we would think we would know what we were going to write about. So Louise Curtis was our production assistant. I still work with Louise. She's one of the producers of the podcast. So Louise and or I, in the early days, it was just me. And then thank goodness Louise came in because she was much better at it than me. But we would do these elaborate research packages ahead of time. So say we were going to Ogdensburg. We would often start reading the local newspaper ahead of time. We'd go on, you know, Facebook groups. We'd start interviewing people and we'd start processing information about that place to try to uncover what the stories might be. So I would maybe say to Louise, like, hey, Louise, we're going to Ogdensburg. And I think we should write about Canadians that come across the border and have PO boxes down in Ogdensburg. So, you know, she'd call up these places and she'd interview some people. She'd maybe find some Canadians who have some. She'd talk to border agents. We'd put together a research package And Stuart and I had a neat little tradition where we wouldn't read it until we were on the train or plane or in the car, or however we were getting to this place. We'd take our binders out with our highlighters and we would independently review these 40, 50 page research packages. And almost always he and I were interested in the same thing. So we'd be like, all right, that's our story. Like, this is the part that interests us, you know? And then we'd hit the ground running. And so we'd get up that first morning and he would go one way and I would go the other way. And I'm telling you, 95% of the time, the story ended up being something completely different than what we thought it was going to be, because we would just try our best to sort of embed ourselves in the community. Yeah, it kind of came together in a pretty funny way, but I miss that. That's probably the, I mean, I miss traveling on tour too, but those recording shows where we really got a feeling of a place and tried to tell a story that gave a sense of what a place was like and who the people were and just captured that moment in time. I loved doing that.
Jess Milton is the host of Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe, a new podcast that digs into the archives of the CBC radio program, The Vinyl Cafe. Milton was the producer until it ended in 2015. She spoke with Mitch Tyke on NCPR's Northwards podcast, and you can find the entire conversation wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 825. I'm Monica Sandreski. We're going to listen to a little bit of music now from the Kingston-based group, The Mills Rights. They're playing at the city's Royal Canadian Horse Artillery Brigade Association this week, and it's not as intense as it sounds. RCHA is just a music venue in Kingston. They go on at 8 o'clock on Friday. This is Mills Rights and their song, Blue Skies.
We all make mistakes and we all pay the price. So we find
The Mills writes in their song Blue Skies. Again, they go on Friday at 8 at the RCHA in Kingston. That is also a group that is based in Kingston, too. That's it for the show for the day. Morning Edition continues in just a minute. After that, it's the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Monica Sandreski.
I'm Todd Moe. Thanks for joining us. Be well.